Wind southwest at 13, 76 degrees Kenosha, 74 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, we're going to be hearing about one of the world's most intriguing birds, the pigeon. But first, we're going to be previewing for you the next production at the Racine Theatre Guild. It's Jonathan Larson's groundbreaking musical, Rent. I'm going to be speaking with Rob Cruz, who is the music director for the production, and Mary Lee Storino, who is the stage director. First, a little taste of Jonathan Larson's score, a little bit of the song called La Vie Bohème.
La Vie Bohème. La Vie Bohème. La Vie Bohème.
Days of inspiration, playing hooky, making something out of nothing. The need to express, to communicate, to going against the grain, going insane, going mad. To love intention, no pension, to more than one dimension, to starving for attention, hating convention, hating prevention, not to mention, of course, hating dear old mom and dad. To riding your bike midday past the three.
So Rob Cruz, you devoted much of your time and energy last summer to Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods. Just say a word about what this undertaking feels like by comparison, Jonathan Larson's Rent. In what ways is this very much the same kind of challenge versus something very different?
I would say in some ways very similar, in some ways very different. For me and my background in musical theater and kind of classical, Into the Woods felt very achievable, knowing that there were going to be challenges because so much of it is sung and it's a difficult, complex, rich score. However, then you turn your attention to Rent and it is as rich and as complex, if not in different ways. This score is almost completely through sung, which poses its own problems of there is so much content to get through. And then additionally, on top of that, a lot of the vocals are pop, rock, musical theater blend, which is not the world in which I personally live. So I felt like this would be a really great stretch for me to kind of lean into that pop, rock sound. So there's lots of great choral numbers that are really rich and difficult, whereas Into the Woods, you have an ensemble of 18, and it's not as complexly divided as it is sometimes in Rent, which actually surprised me. I didn't realize how complex some of the scoring actually was.
Wow, that's a surprise to me, too, although I don't know Rent real thoroughly, but I've seen it performed twice, and I would not have guessed that to be the case. So that's really interesting. So it sounds like this has turned out to be a satisfying but very formidable challenge for you and your cast, musically speaking.
Yeah, I really think even the score itself, as I was given it, it almost is a time capsule as you're sitting and looking at this. Jonathan Larson, actually, the composer, died the night before Rent's off-Broadway premiere. So when you get this script from the Musical Theater International Company, I'm not sure that they did much to touch or do anything to the actual written score. So as you're sitting and trying to decipher who's doing what, some of it is block chords that you're as the music composer, having to find through lines through of who sings what and who does what. So there's been a little bit of piecing together, which is just a component of having a composer that wasn't here to give us every written detail that he probably could have if he were alive.
Fascinating. Wow. Yes, let's talk a little bit about the backstory of this musical, Jonathan Larson's Rent, a modern-day adaption of one of history's most beloved operas, Giacomo Puccini's La Bohème. What can you tell us, first of all, about Jonathan Larson and the circumstances under which this was composed? And also remind us about when this was composed, just how old a work is this by now?
Yeah, so we're talking 1996, and Jonathan Larson, the whole, it's very reflective of him and his group of friends and how he himself was an artist. Rent follows a group of friends and artists in 1990s New York. They're dealing with love and loss, of course, but they're also dealing with the AIDS epidemic at the time. And so this musical really broke new ground in talking about AIDS on stage. We actually have a musical about people having to deal with love and loss and having to come to terms with losing friendships. And so this was being composed, and in its off-Broadway premiere, there was lots of buzz. And Jonathan Larson, as I said, passed away the night before that first off-Broadway premiere. And instead of canceling, they went on and did the show, and it just sparked such a revolution. When you think of musicals that have really changed our time, you think of Oklahoma, and Hair has really changed the landscape of musical theater. And we, of course, have Hamilton in modern times, but Rent was our piece in the 90s that really changed what musical theater could say and what it could do.
And I suppose it also changed the way in which it could say what it said. I mean, it's not just that the content is different, the themes are different, but also Jonathan Larson's musical language was unlike anything that had quite been heard. I mean, not that there weren't rock elements like this before Rent, but it seems to me, to my amateur ear, that he used the rock idiom maybe in a more sophisticated way than had ever been used before.
Yes, and we hear a lot of, he's very clever in how he has taken a lot of those thematic elements throughout the motifs. You hear, similar to Sondheim, you hear a motif kind of travel all the way through, and these characters have their own themes. But now you hear it in, okay, this character is rock-driven, or this character is really pop, or I can hear grunge aspects inside of this character's throughway. So it's really interwoven quite beautifully throughout.
We're speaking with Rob Cruz, and we are talking about the musical Rent by Jonathan Larson, which is performed this coming weekend at the Racine Theater Guild and the following weekend as well. Rob, can you tell us anything more about Jonathan Larson, who, as you already mentioned, died on the eve of the world premiere of this, his greatest work? Do you happen to know anything more about him? I know that he, of course, did not live to create all that much for the world, but of course he will be immortal in music history because of Rent itself.
Yeah, we also have his other work, Tick, Tick, Boom, which just happened to be filmed as a Netflix, I believe it's Netflix special. So, but that's his only other like substantial work that we have to hold on to, and I'm so glad it got to be celebrated in that way. If you haven't seen it, it is a beautifully filmed piece of musical theater. And that piece talks about his life. He seems to really connect to that artist struggle and that artist life, and it's seen in Tick, Tick, Boom, and it's also reflective in Rent as well. One of the nice things that I think is he is not just pop rock. He has such a knowledge of past genres, and you see it in Rent, where it is inspired by La Boheme, one of the really nice parallels, I think, is if you're an opera person, which I know you, Greg, are 100%, but there's that beautiful sequence in Act 2 of La Boheme with the oranges, dates, hot chestnuts, the shopping scene. And that's paralleled so beautifully in the Act 1 almost finale called Christmas Bells and Shopping. You see all sorts of characters bargaining and shopping about, and you have Coline, or in this case, Rent Collins. They actually buy a coat. You have a really beautiful parallel to in La Boheme, the Follow Parpignol sequence. However, Rent is an R-rated show, and so in this case, they're following the man, following the drug dealer. So he really was an intelligent person, an intelligent composer who drew inspiration, but also has such beautiful subtle nods to, if you know the opera, you're going to catch little glimpses of it in this piece. So it's very sad that we don't get to see what could have happened next, because there's such intelligence in the score and in the writing. It's very intentional.
Right. And you've really touched on something essential, I think, which is what might Jonathan Larson have gone on to compose. I mean, for one thing, it's really intriguing to think about other Jonathan Larson works that might have been drawn by or parallel to other operas, but even beyond that, what he might have gone on to do had he lived longer. Well, at least we have his Rent, and of course we have the opportunity now to experience it. Rob Cruz, take us back to the experience of auditions, and I was on hand for some of the auditions helping out, and so I know at least some of the talented people who walked through the door to audition for this piece. It sounds like this is one of those shows, like a short list of others, in which you say you're doing Rent and a whole lot of talented people are going to show up interested in being part of it.
Yeah, there is just such buzz and interest around the show. People that are musical theater people, people that have grown up with this, they want to be in this show. So when we had auditions, you could just see people are excited, and there's this want and desire to be a part of this production. And that's a testament to what the production means to people. So we had such enthusiasm to come out. The director, Mary Lee, and myself, these people are called Rent Heads. They live for Rent. And so the talent we had was overwhelming. And so when it came down to casting, a majority of the people in the cast are brand new to the Racine Theater Guild. They have never stepped through the door until Rent happened. So that's a big win for us, because we love seeing new talent and being able to showcase new talent at the Racine Theater Guild. But also we have a lot of people who have returned to the Theater Guild, who have been on our stage, who are veterans, who have done something. Some people haven't done something in 9-10 years almost, but they have returned because Rent is something that they wanted to do. So the buzz and the interest surrounding the show really is a testament to the material, but also to these wonderful people that feel so connected.
Right. Sounds familiar in terms of the production we just finished, Sweeney Todd, a similar kind of work in which a whole lot of people just have this burning desire to somehow be part of it. And of course, other great shows are kind of a similar dimension, but certainly Rent is one of them. And clearly, on the strength of this marvelous cast you have assembled, we're in for something really, really special. Tell our listeners about one or two of the specifically musical highlights that you think are especially interesting or impressive that they should be listening for, aside from what you've already mentioned.
Yeah, so when we think of Rent, we think it's big and loud, and we have vocal pyrotechnics as it is. And that's true, and that's going to happen. What I think has been so satisfying as a music director is kind of digging into realizing this is an ensemble piece. And when that ensemble, that whole group of them is on stage, that's when, to me, my heart soars. And we've really worked towards finding musical moments. Like, obviously, where is the height of the song and everything else, but also where can you sit and listen and enjoy each other's sound and have the opportunity to sing with intention. So you're going to hear that in songs like Will I and some of the therapy songs, but also Seasons of Love. It's not big and blasty at every moment. There is some real subtlety to the sound where we've relaxed the tone and let the text take the forefront. There's just some really beautiful ensemble work. So anytime that big group is out there, it is just a treat. Yes, the soloists are fantastic, and the belting and all of the other things are amazing. But for me, the heart of the piece is in that ensemble.
Hmm. As far as you're concerned, what is the central theme of this show, Jonathan Larson's Rent?
Yeah, I would say it lies within that Seasons of Love. We're given so much time, and it really is dependent on what we do with it. And you see these characters make a lot of different choices throughout the piece, and they're connected to one specific character, that angel character, who lives life to their fullest. And when we lose that character, it kind of tells those characters, wow, we have only so much time. There's only so much time that we get to be in this world, and the choices that we make are going to be showcase who we are as a human being. So our humanity is shown through that kind of context. Who we are in the time we have is, to me, what the show is about.
Beautifully put. Rob Cruz, music director for the Racine Theater Guild's production of Rent. Thank you so much for being my morning show guest today.
Thanks, Greg. I appreciate it.
525,600 minutes.
And now I'm really happy to be speaking with Mary Lee Storino, who is the stage director for Rent. And if you've attended things at the Racine Theater Guild, you have certainly seen her name in programs because she's been the choreographer for quite a number of productions. In fact, Mary Lee, I've lost count. How many are we talking about at this point in time?
So Joseph, and then Sister Act, and then Mamma Mia. And no, 9 to 5, then Mamma Mia, then Little Mermaid. So does that six?
Something like that. Yeah. But this is a little bit of a new venture for you. That is, maybe there is a bit of choreography involved in Rent, but you are the stage director for Rent. So
yes, and there's actually more choreography than people might think. There's a tango section. There's a lot of table choreography when we do La Vie Boheme. It is definitely mostly staging, but there was absolutely some dancing in there as well.
So tell us about what it feels like to be the stage director, and how much experience do you have doing this? Or is this, in a sense, kind of a new adventure for you?
It is. This is my second, rodeo, I guess, if you will, as director/choreographer. I was able to fulfill those two roles together at the Roadie. For Rocky Horror before COVID, and that was about it. That's the only opportunity I've had to direct and choreograph. So it feels exciting and, a little, scary. It's been really fun. I have a very, very good team at the Guild. Bob Benson, my production stage manager, has taken a lot off of my plate, and it's been wonderful.
Wonderful. So tell us about your own personal experience with Jonathan Larson's Rent ahead of this production. Is this something you have ever been in or played any part of in terms of previous productions?
Yes, I've never been in it. I'm a Rent head, so they call really super fans of Rent heads. And I would definitely identify with that category. I actually started listening to it in, like, grade school. It's adult content, but I grew up in a theater, home. And so, we always knew to separate, what's for the theater and what's for real life. And so I grew up listening to Rent. I've known every single word since I was in middle school. And when I found out that the Guild was doing it, I thought, oh, my gosh, I would love the opportunity to stage this. And so I'm happy that I was given it.
So what does it feel like to have that responsibility and opportunity with a work that you have known so intimately for such a long time? I mean, did you already have in your mind lots of thoughts about exactly how you wanted this to look?
Yes, I really wanted to honor Jonathan Larson's original, vision and to get as close to that as we can. And like I said, Bob, who has also doubled as my costume designer, and Taylor as costuming as well, they have done an incredible job of bringing the mid-90s to the Guild, and the whole look of the show is very, very close to the original production, so I'm really happy about that. And same thing with the choreography and the staging, as well as the qualities of some of the characters as far as their ethnicity and all of that. I really wanted to stay as close to the original as physically possible. And I think we've done a pretty darn good job, to be honest.
So can you be a little more specific about that matter that you were just now talking about?
Totally. So in the original production, the man that plays Tom Collins is African-American descent. The person who plays Angel is Latinx. The person who plays Mimi is Latinx. It was really important to me to, if we could, to get people of those ethnicities to properly represent those roles, and we did. And then as far as the look, it takes place in the mid-90s in New York City, and it's really about a lot of people who are just struggling. They're poor, they don't have any money, they don't have any real jobs, they're really trying to, pursue their dreams and their art, and it's a struggle in the process, and a lot of them are sick with HIV, and so it's just, it was an iconic show in the 90s, and it still is so relevant today. And we just really wanted to pay homage to the original, thing in that regard.
So what was it that drew you so powerfully to the work way back when? I mean, because as you've already alluded to, you were certainly not of the target audience or maybe the kind of musical theater fan who would necessarily, we would think of as a Rent fan. I mean, what do you think about it was such a powerful draw for you?
I love the music. It was the first, rock opera of its time. We have Sweeney and we have Les Mis and we have these musicals where there's very little dialogue, if any, and it's an opera. This was the first rock opera. And so as a kid, I just thought the music was so dang fun. I just loved to rock out to it. And then as I got older, I was like, wow, this is deep. These characters are really, struggling. And it's just, you're drawn to them and you care about them. Or at least I do. I care about the characters.
Hmm. So I talked with Rob about this, but I wanted to talk to you about this as well. I participated in in part of your auditions as the pianist. So I got to hear for myself the really ferocious level of talent that walked through the door, a little bit reminiscent of what happened with our production of Sweeney Todd. And I can think of a couple of other productions where there's just Rob's word was a buzz surrounding the title of certain works where you just have so many people longing for the opportunity to be part of it. And certainly that seems to have been the case with Rent as well.
Oh, yeah. We had many video submissions. I think we had 12 or maybe upwards of 15 video submissions, as well as over 70 in-person auditions for what was originally supposed to be a 16-person cast. And I just couldn't. I had to use more people. So we have 20.
Hmm. So tell us what you sort of envision as the central themes or the dynamics that go on between these characters, and what you have tried to do as the stage director to, in a sense, be the caretaker of some of that.
Totally. So something that's actually really, I don't want to say up and coming in the theater world, because many people have been doing it for a decade or more, but for the vast majority of people, I would say it's a new concept of intimacy direction. And so that's actually not the how things are, you know, evolving, is that that's not really the job of the actual director, because that can create some power dynamics that are hard to overcome. So we had an intimacy director come in, Christopher Elf, who is, you know, a big name up in the Milwaukee area. Him and his follower partner, Nicole, came, and they worked with us on all of these incredibly intimate moments. There are moments, you know, that are, like I said, it's rated R. The content for Rent is definitely adult. So for all of those moments, we were very fortunate to have Christopher come work with us. And then as far as my, you know, my staging of it, I just really wanted to make sure that we are, the Guild is an interesting space. I call it the thrustiest of thrusts. So it's a thrust stage, but really, truly, as a director, you have to pretend that you're almost in the round. 86% of your body, you know, is being seen by any member of the audience at a certain angle. So it's really important for, as we directed it, that we make sure, you know, okay, when you cross downstage, you have to turn back so they can see you. And then, you know, when you climb up the ladder, you've got to go open this side, and then you've got to open to the other side. So we really had to pay special attention to make sure that we're doing, you know, the Guild justice as far as their space and then the blocking of the actors.
Hmm. So how has this felt different from other shows where you were just the choreographer? I mean, not that that isn't plenty of responsibility, but to have responsibility, in a sense, for everything visual. How different has that felt for you?
So different. So in rehearsal proper, when I'm in rehearsal and I'm with the actors and we're working, that doesn't feel any different. That I feel very much, you know, in my element there. It's all of the correspondence and, you know, the things afterwards and the emails and, you know, making sure that you've got the sets and the costumes and the lights and the sound and, you know, all those aspects now need my opinion, whereas before they really did not. I was there to, you know, polish and clean the dancing, maybe help with a little bit of staging, and that's about it. So just, you know, having my opinion be taken into account for all of those aspects has been, you know, different. Like I said, it's kind of equal parts exciting and, you know, a little daunting. But I, like I said, I've had an incredible team. I think at a different theater, it would have been a lot more stressful. And this really has not, I would not call this process stressful at all.
Hmm. So we're actually recording this interview early in this final week of rehearsals, but it is airing Friday. It is airing the morning that you open. But at this point, early in this last week of rehearsals, how do things stand? Are you, in a sense, just about ready to open, or is it going to be a frantic dash to the finish line?
No, like I said, I think this process has been one of the least stressful, you know, tech weeks. Rent is really about the story. We've been reminiscing about 9 to 5. I don't know if you remember, Greg, but that tech week was, you know, all those desks and all those, you know, the moving parts and the set came on and off, and there was 14 desks and typewriters and chairs. Rent is, we move on tables, we move off tables. We move on benches, we move them off. There are very few set changes. There are very few quick changes. You know, all those things that make tech week feel, you know, like a little bit, you know, stressful. We're not really running into any of those problems. And so I think at this point, we just need an audience. And that's a great place to be. What a blessing.
Fantastic. So tell our listeners how many opportunities they have to see the Racine Theatre Guild's production of Rent.
So this Friday we open, and I believe we had less than 50 tickets left, which is incredible. So if you are here for that opening night energy, I would not wait. Then we've got double shows on Saturday and then an afternoon matinee on Sunday and then the exact same schedule the following weekend. So we have Friday night, 2 shows Saturday, and then we close her out Sunday the 23rd at 2 p.m.
Fantastic. So people can go to the website, racinetheater.org, or call 262-633-4218. for Tickets to Rent by Jonathan Larson. And what an exciting moment this is in the history of the Racine Theater Guild. And Mary Lee Sterino at the helm as stage director. Thanks for being my guest today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you and the cast and crew of Rent.
Thank you so much.
525,600 minutes, 525,000 journeys to plan, 525,600 minutes. How do you measure the life of a woman or a man?
In truth that she learned, or in times that he cried, in bridges he burned, or the way that she
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show Archives. Well, we certainly managed to talk about a whole lot of different things here on The Morning Show, and today our topic is the pigeon. I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Andrew Bleckman, an award-winning journalist who has written a new book called Pigeons, The Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird. Andrew Bleckman has written for both the Los Angeles Times and Des Moines Register, Smithsonian Magazine, the New York Times, and he has written such an interesting book about pigeons and the way in which they have figured in our national consciousness in both positive and not so positive ways. I mean, worshipped and derided and everything really in between. And it's fascinating to think a little more specifically about these birds, which especially in our metropolitan areas are around us all the time. Again, the book is Pigeons, The Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird, published by Grove Press. And Andrew Bleckman, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Appreciate you joining me. You talk in the introduction of the book about how for most of your life you didn't need to have much opinion about pigeons, and then at some point that started to change.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing was an accident. I'm not a bird person or even a pigeon person. In fact, I don't own a pair of binoculars. I bought my first bird feeder for my house over here where I live for the first time just last year. Yeah, I tripped across it, but the more I learned about the bird, the more I really came to admire it.
Well, one of the things you say is that maybe among all birds and maybe all animals, no creature has as unique and continuous a relationship with humans as the common pigeon. Explain what you mean by that.
It's uncanny. First of all, the pigeon has been our best friend for about 10,000 years. They were domesticated not long after our other best friend, the dog. And pigeons have been used by just about every civilization in human history because of their ability to courier messages. And they were used by the ancient Greeks deliver word of the first Olympics in 776 B.C. They're used to deliver word of Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo 2,500 years later. And there were 1 million pigeons served in World War I and World War II, saving literally thousands of our boys' lives. And they're still being used around the world by a lot of different militaries.
So there is this connection, and yet there's this other side to our relationship with the pigeon, which is, in a sense, exactly the opposite.
Yeah, it's a very, you know, it's turned into a very cruel situation. It's extremely docile, unaggressive bird, extraordinarily bright. They're almost like dolphins of the sky, and you'll never come across an aggressive pigeon. But in the last 50 years, its reputation has just spiraled downwards. Going from something that's beloved, in fact, it was the pigeon that brought the olive branch to Noah, that was the it was representative of Jesus and the Holy Spirit in artwork all through the Renaissance and even in the Bible. And it just spiraled downwards. Just the last 50 years, the only thing I can attribute it to is the pest control industry spent literally tens of millions of dollars in the last 50 years. It closely parallels the bird's reputation falling apart. And they've spent a lot of money to demonize it as a vermin.
Yeah, flying rat.
Yeah, but you know what? It's only as dirty as our cities are. I mean, pigeons are where we are. They like us. And you know, keep in mind, they survive only off what we drop. And they carry no more diseases than you or I. And then on top of that, they seem to be immune or partially immune to avian flu and West Nile virus.
Hmm. So there may be some other ways in which the pigeon ultimately is useful for us. You say that the pigeon is actually an athlete of the highest caliber. Explain that a little further.
You know, it stunned me when I learned about it. It also stunned me that, well, they're used for racing. At least, you know, some of them are. They're called homers. They're basically purebreds. And I didn't even realize the Queen of England is a pigeon racer, as was her father and grandfather and great-grandfather, as are the people on the rooftops in New York City that I profile in the book. They are able to routinely fly 600 miles without stopping for food, water, or rest from a place they've never been before. They come home like a laser-guided missile somehow, and they average 60 miles an hour. Now, by comparison, a racehorse is traveling about 35 to 40 miles an hour on a closed track for only about a mile and a quarter.
Wow. That does say something about what they're able to do, doesn't it?
Yeah, they're just unbelievable athletes.
So we have these pigeons that over the course of many years have been used for the carrying of important messages. Do we know what it is about the pigeon that makes it so skilled? I mean, and why they have been so easy to domesticate in this sense?
You know, it's interesting. We do and we don't. The first thing is, first of all, the pigeon is a dove, and it's a rock dove. And it comes from, you know, it's a cliff dweller, basically, and it would forage inland for food. But it'll never abandon its nest or its young. And when they mate for life, so they always come home. So this was developed over, you know, tens of thousands of years, their ability to find their nest again. Now, that has been honed to a science at this point. How they do it? You know, I've talked to the very, very top people in the field. There's a guy at Cornell who's dedicated his entire life to trying to figure this one out, a top scientist. And first thing he'd say is, we don't know for sure. Second thing he would say is, well, they're able to sense the Earth's magnetic field and navigate using that, almost like they have a compass inside them. Secondly, they're able to use the sun and the stars to navigate. But you know, interestingly, a blindfolded pigeon will also make its way home, as will a pigeon that has little magnets on its head, although it'll start in the wrong direction, usually. Interestingly, too, they have a super ultrasound hearing, and they're able to somehow place themselves, because they can hear wind over the Rockies, for example, from 2,000 miles away.
That's extraordinary. One of the things you talk about is a very dark day in history, the 1st of September, 1914. The only instance in history, you say, when the moment of a species extinction is known. Tell us what happened on the 1st of September, 1914.
Yeah, it was just tragic. That was when the last passenger pigeon died. Her name was Martha. She was in captivity at a zoo in Cincinnati. And they couldn't find a mate for her. And that was it. That was the last passenger pigeon. At one time, the passenger pigeon, which is related to the rock dove, or the common pigeon that we think of, was the most numerous bird on the planet. Billions of these, not millions, billions of passenger pigeons. And it's hard to believe, but they would actually obscure the sky for days at a time. And it's hard to believe, but John Muir wrote about it. Audubon wrote about it. There's lots and lots of eyewitness accounts of it. But we were able to slaughter it into extinction within about 100 years or so. We overhunted it, and then we destroyed its nesting grounds. And that was it. It was gone.
One of the things you've done in this book is gotten to know various people who are either fascinated with pigeons or devoted to them or maybe devoted to their destruction. One of the most interesting figures is a guy with the last name of Roth or Roth, R-O-T-H, David.
Dave Roth.
Dave Roth. Tell us about him.
You know, he's an interesting guy, and some people might see him as a nutty character. Because, I mean, he is, there is a piece of him that's a bit insane, almost quixotic about him. And I actually saw him as just a really interesting guy with a very eccentric side. He has dedicated his life to trying to educate the public about humane pigeon control. And that he's been somewhat successful about. He's actually changed the way Phoenix and much of Arizona performs pigeon control. Now the other side of Dave Roth is that he lives with pigeons in his house, and not just some, but a lot. And he doesn't clean his house. So,
you say he has two aviaries with about 60 birds.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, it was very difficult to even be in his house, and we actually quickly left. I kind of had that fear in my eyes of like a deer caught in a headlight walking around that house. I mean, he's what you, I guess you would call a confirmed bachelor.
Right. Well, and you say that, you know, even as he's taking his campaign throughout actually much of the world, I mean, working to try to scale back pigeon extermination programs in various cities, in some ways, his biggest challenge is just the guy he lives next door to. I mean, the guy right down the street who's so frustrated living with someone with all these pigeons.
Yeah, beheaded a pigeon and threw it on his doorstep. It's just it's amazing the cruelty. Well, you know what? This is where hate takes you. I mean, hate has an inevitable conclusion. We've seen it all through history with people, animals, all sorts of things. And with pigeons, that's where it takes it. In fact, there's people whose careers are poaching or stealing pigeons off city streets, selling them to middlemen who then sell them to gun clubs where they're used as live fodder for nothing more than target practice and competition, just like clay pigeons, which were actually used or invented to actually replace live pigeons at the turn of the century because it was seen as inhumane. They're now routinely slaughtered at these gun clubs, thousands in a morning, and they're just left on the fields to die.
You say that, it's an obvious point, but worth saying again, is that just as a culture, we tend to become more and more hygienic. I mean, nearly by the day, it seems.
Absolutely.
And of course, in the face of that societal tendency, a bird like the pigeon, which is everywhere in our cities, is going to have a target on its head.
It absolutely is, you know, and that is a problem. I mean, everyone has a right to be upset by too many droppings, you know, but first of all, wildlife is inconvenient. I mean, that's just a reality of life. So is raising a two-year-old. I have a two-year-old at home, but I absolutely adore her, and I'm learning so much from her. And you can learn a lot from wildlife. It really animates who we are. Secondly, humane pigeon control is not that difficult. Too much of anything, you know, it becomes a problem. Too much sugar gives you a stomach ache. You know, too many pigeons leads to way too many droppings. But humane pigeon control, which is the only pigeon control that actually works, poisoning does not work in the long term, can easily reduce a city's pigeon population. So it really doesn't become a problem.
You point out how really there are some double standards going on here, maybe even triple standards in terms of what we tolerate in terms of the presence of other birds versus pigeons. I mean, it's so interesting what might be going on here, which causes people to be so focused on pigeons. You suggest, I think, that one of the problems, in a sense, is that the pigeons like us as much as they do, that they're so comfortable around us, and so they're right there with us.
Yeah, and there are more of them. But, you know, it's interesting. They're taken for granted. And, look, you know, I've had readings around the country for my book. And, interestingly, even in my hometown, the local Audubon Society nor the Bird Club will have anything to do with co-sponsoring the reading because they consider the pigeon an invasive species, which is actually quite, you know, they're considered feral, which means they're not domestic but not wild, so they're really, they just fall through the cracks. There's charities all over the country and international treaties that are dedicated to nothing but protecting birds, but the pigeon falls through all of them. They're basically an unprotected creature.
Fascinating. Your study of the pigeon took you across the path of quite a number of interesting people, and a couple of them people we've heard of, including boxer Mike Tyson. Explain to our listeners why in the world you were interested in trying to talk with Mike Tyson.
Well, he's a fascinating character, simply put. Secondly, he's a, he's one of the, you know, he's certainly our country's most famous pigeon fancier. You know, in the rest of the world, it would be the Queen of England who's a pigeon fancier. And he's a hard guy to get in touch with. But if you think about it, why, you know, why does Mike Tyson love pigeons so much? And if you're a kid growing up in a ghetto, you know, it's just such a restricted and difficult world. For him to watch his birds fly around unimpeded above him in the sky from his rooftop was probably the only sense of freedom that he had. It gave him a real sense of peace. And interestingly, after his last bout with Kevin McBride, where, you know, he unexpectedly lost and lost so horribly, he said at the news conference that he just wants to get home and be with his birds.
Hmm.
Keeps hundreds of them still.
Wow. He just wanted to be home with his pigeons.
That's right.
You do tell us about this interesting phenomenon of pigeon racing. And just explain briefly how these races typically occur.
Sure. Well, let me simply put, a pigeon does not go from A to B, but it can go from B back to A. In fact, it always will. So these birds are shipped collectively. All the racing guys take their birds to the clubhouse, and they're placed on a truck where they're fed and watered, and then they're trucked out maybe 500, 600, 300, whatever miles. And then they're all released at the same time at dawn. And then the birds all come back, and it's the first bird in that wins the race. They all go back to their home loft, and to get specific about it, they actually do their average flying time, because every loft slightly a different distance from another. But it's calculated through aerial surveys. And then they're punch-clocked in with these tamper-proof clocks. And then the races are then tallied, and you have winners. And in some parts of the world, actually in our country as well, in Vegas area, you actually have million-dollar races where these birds can bring in $1 million in a race and then sell for tens of thousands at auction and then stud out for thousands at a time.
Your book is also, among many things, helpful in helping us understand what's a pigeon, what's a dove, that sort of thing. You actually tell kind of an amusing story, believe it or not, in the wake of 9/11 and Jersey City's first memorial to 9/11. In which an interesting mistake is made by the organizers of that very poignant event.
Yeah, collectively we know so little about this bird that we take for granted, and that ended up happening. You know those beautiful birds that little white birds that you see that are released at weddings. They circle above and they fly off into the great unknown. Those are just homing pigeons. They're just white, so they're considered doves, but they're just white homers. And all they're doing is orienting themselves and then flying home, where they'll then be used again at another wedding. And they're used to ceremonies, and that particular ceremony, the gentleman who organized it didn't know anything about the bird. So, and all the birds that he tried to reserve some, they were all taken, for that day for ceremonies across the metro region. So he just went to the live poultry market, and picked up a bunch of squabs because they were white.
Baby pigeons, in
baby
other words.
That's just it. The definition of a squab is a pigeon that's never flown before. And he released them, and they had absolutely no idea what to do. Some of them could barely fly. Most of them ended up going into buildings. And the other ones just kind of fell into the water because they couldn't even sustain their flight very long. They were just babies.
Mm. Do you feel like your book has made any difference in courting a different opinion about pigeons?
I got to say this. Any animal in the animal kingdom deserves another look. It really is this creature with an unparalleled athletic ability and an unparalleled history. I mean, heroic birds, and they saved thousands of lives in the wars. Has it had an effect? I can only hope it will have an effect. I really do. Like I said, I'm not a bird person. I'm not an advocate. I tripped across this as a common journalist, and I was just fascinated by what I found.
Hmm. Your book is fascinating indeed. Pigeons, the Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird, published by Grove Press, the author Andrew Bleckman. Andrew Bleckman, thank you for your time and for writing such an interesting book.
Well, I got to tell you, that was a wonderful interview. Thank you very much.
Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. And it's also available as a podcast. And on the weekends, you can hear morning shows from sometimes the distant